Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm delighted to talk to Lawrence Grobel, who is an interviewer par excellence. He has written a number of books and has interviewed everybody, hundreds of people, some of the most famous people in the culture, including Marlon Brando, Barbara Streisand, Richard Feynman, just everyone, Dolly Parton, Kurt Russell, Goldie Hawn. I could just go on and on and on. Al Pacino, he is the biographer of Al Pacino. It's a great honor to talk to him. And one of the things I kept into the recording, so I hope you enjoy it, is we started off quite loosely and we were just chatting. And it's such a fun way to start the interview. I kept it intact and did very little editing so that you could just enjoy us as we go along our way. His books are available from Amazon and anywhere you can find good books. I'll put some links in the show notes. You can follow us on Twitter at Dr. Jonty, DrJonty. That's me on Twitter, I should say. You could follow Writers on Film on Twitter at Writers on Film 1. You can like the episode, review the episode, share the episode. You know the drill. If you don't, if you're a first time listener, then please do. Please let me know. Give me any feedback you like. I would like to hear your thoughts on what you think of the episode or what you think of the show in general. But before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation. I'm such a narcissist, I end up looking at myself and not concentrating on the other person.
Well, that's, you know, when I was doing all the cable TV interviews I did for Playboy as well, I hated looking at myself on camera, you know, I mean, and I'd have to edit it. So I kept saying, let's just put the camera on the subject, just put two cameras on the subject, get me out of it. And eventually they did it that way. And I thought it was better. But also it was like, I didn't have to be self-conscious about, oh, why am I wearing this? Why am I that? Well, how come I'm wearing sandals? And then it shows, you know, stupid things.
It's funny because when I edit these podcasts, which I do very, very lightly, I have a very light hand. I like to keep the conversation. But the one thing I try to do is cut out as much of me as possible. And so, yeah. So people go, oh, it's great. You let your guests speak. And it's like, yeah, but I kind of cut myself out. That's why you think that.
Well, I do the same thing all the time. I mean, I talk way too much when I do interviews. And it's what one might call it one's style, because I got, I was able to do 5-hour interviews or 5-day interviews. So, I basically talked a lot, because I wanted my subject to feel, hey, why is he doing all the talking? So they would come in and have that, what they had to say. And then I would cut out all the stuff I had to say. I know what I don't need to, have myself in the interview a great deal if I can cut down the question to, a sentence.
How did you get started? I mean, I've just finished reading your wonderful book, You Talking to Me. After Robert De Niro's 80th birthday, it seems like an apt book to have read. What an entertaining. So I know quite a lot about your life, but I'd love to introduce you a little bit more to our listeners.
Fine. But before we do, though, I just want to ask you, you've got an English accent and you're living in Italy?
Yeah, right. I've been in Italy for 20 odd years now. Came here with my girlfriend to teach at university, and then just stuck here. And I've lived here.
Where's here? Where do you live?
Here is near, it's between Venice and the beginning of the Dolomite Mountains. So I can go down to Venice to do my university work on the train. And then I come home and I'm in the mountains, not quite the Dolomites, but I'm in the what are called the pre-Alps. Just before.
And do you get, and do you make a living from teaching?
Teaching is my sort of solid day job, sort of monthly check, which I can rely on, which in times of COVID and other times has been extremely grateful. And the journalism is a very good, is proving increasingly significant in helping out. Okay. I do know a lot of journalists who are going in the other direction, journalists who were full-time but are now getting day jobs because they just can't support themselves anymore.
Yeah, it's very tough. So it's good to hear. Okay, and are you making, is what we're doing now part of your journalism, or is this a sidebar and you write stuff?
It's kind of a sidebar. Yes, it's definitely a sidebar, because I mainly write stuff for Variety, Sight and Sound, a whole bunch of places. And I'm just finishing the first book, which is a biography of Terrence Malick. So that's been my big sort of project for the last year and a half.
And that's a book that probably very few people will read, correct?
I'm not sure. I mean, there isn't a bio. It depends on how Terrence's next film does, really. I think his reputation.
I'm not being cynical. I'm just thinking, it's so hard to, when we put out these books, how many people see them, who's interested in them. Malick has had more failure than he has success, I guess, but he's had tremendous good reviews when he was starting out. He was sort of an Orson, not a Stanley Kubrick, Orson Welles type figure, that he was like, wow, this guy's doing great stuff. And then all of a sudden he just went in another, his films just didn't get well reviewed and things happened. But anyway, it'll be interesting to see your book.
Yeah. I mean, that's what's interesting about doing this podcast is I do recognize that it's niche to be interested in books about movies and about Hollywood and all that. But it feels like we're having a kind of renaissance, that we're getting some great books and they're climbing up the New York Times bestseller list, and people like Sam Wasson with his book about Chinatown, and Glenn Frankel with his book about The Searchers, and there's some stuff out there that's really becoming popular. So I'm hoping to encourage that.
Right. Okay. All right. So let's start. Just be my concern as always with my internet. Sometimes it goes, it'll just stop. You know what I mean? It's like even if it's a minute or 20 seconds, it stops and I'm out of it, and then we have to reconnect. So let's see if we can get as much done as we can. If I lose you, I'll try to get back on. If I can't, we'll email about it.
Okay, cool. Great.
Okay.
And any interruptions, anything like that, I can easily edit out.
Right.
So yeah, just the what I was saying earlier, to tell you the truth, I kind of tend to leave all this in. You talking?
That's whatever you want, whatever you like.
It's kind of funny that talking to you, I was thinking, oh, how do I interview an interviewer? And then now I realize I don't. I get interviewed by the interviewer.
I usually do like to know something about the person I'm talking to. That's just by nature, I guess. I often think that this is pre-interview, so I'm asking you these things. But if you want to include it, by all means, you know, I have no objection.
Great, great. And so how, let me repeat the question just before we went off to John Land, to what my daughters call Radio John.
How old are your daughters?
Oh, 19 and 22.
Oh, good for you.
Yeah.
Mine are a little older. I got two also.
Oh, how old are they?
Oh boy, one is 39, the other's 42.
Wow. Oh,
is right. I can't believe it myself.
yeah, that must be a pinch me moment. And just two girls?
Two girls, three grandchildren. That's it.
Wow. I love having girls. Girls, you know, I mean, I know you're supposed to be neutral and you would love, you know, before they're born, definitely you'd love any sex. But having had two girls, it was perfect.
I don't disagree, but I would have loved one more. I would have loved to try a boy. But my wife said, shop is closed.
We're done.
Two is enough. Yeah. I said, all right, I can't fight her.
Fair enough. So when did you start out asking people questions? What's your background?
Hold on a second. You haven't even introduced me.
I'll do a little pre. Don't worry. I'll do a pre thing where I do all that. So it's
okay. Hey, and people start listening to this from the beginning. I'm asking you about your children. You're asking me about mine, and why are we listening to this?
They don't believe me that they're used to it.
Okay. So I say what was your question? How did I start out?
Yeah. How did you start out asking people questions and getting paid?
Well,
for it
was never my intention to be an interviewer. When I was young, there were certain novelists that really turned me on, and I just appreciated good writing. I appreciated good literature. I read Dostoevsky when I was like 15, and I read Kafka and J.D. Salinger and Norman Mailer and James Joyce just blew me away. And then I got to J.P. Donlevy, and they're just Philip Roth, Saul Bellow, a lot of these writers. And I said, God, wouldn't it be great to be able to write like that? You know, I mean, to be able to create work. So I went away I was in college. I edited my campus humor magazine. In high school, I was the editor of my school newspaper. So I was writing, you know, and I wrote, when I was 15 years old, I won an essay contest about America's three greatest presidents, and Newsday published it. And the essay was published in the newspaper. I got a watch that I still wear today engraved. And then the big thing was to go to Washington, D.C. at the end of the year and meet President Kennedy. And so I did go, but Kennedy was in Berlin at the time. So I met Bobby Kennedy, the attorney general and the head of the FBI, and, you know, a lot of these kind of things. So I saw when I was 15 that writing paid. You know, I mean, it didn't necessarily mean money paid, but it got you attention. It distinguished you among your peers. You know, all of a sudden in the school, they all of a sudden knew who I was in a different way. So, you know, that there was something about that. And then when I went to college and I became the editor of the humor magazine for 3 years, and I wrote a column, again, I was writing prose and I was writing satire and humor, whatever it was I was doing. I went to join the Meredith, Mississippi March in 1965 during the summer, and marched with Dr. Martin Luther King and all, and wrote about that for Newsday and for UCLA. So I wasn't really doing interviews, you know, I was writing. Mm-hmm. But then when I went to Ghana, I went to the Peace Corps for 3 years. And in Ghana, I met this rather remarkable sculptor named Vincent Kofi. And he would get the tree trunks, and he would carve, you know, do his carvings based on the knots and the holes that were in the tree, and he would make mouths at them and whatever. And so it was very fascinating to see what he did. And I went to Kumasi where he was teaching, and I went to his home, and I walked through the woods with him as he picked out his wood. And then I suggested an article to African Arts Magazine at the time. This is 1970. And they said, yeah, go ahead and do it. So I wrote to Kofi. He came down to Accra where I was living. I got 6 bottles of beer, and I got a reel-to-reel tape recorder that I borrowed. And so he was really my first interview, you know, asking him about how he did what he did and all. And I wrote it up, but not as a Q&A, but as a profile. Then when I got back, I spent 3 years in Africa, and I was writing a novel. I was writing other stuff, and then I traveled for 8 months around the world, and getting as much experience as I could. I sort of felt, you know, the need to experience this a lot because I wanted to be a writer, you know. And so I got back to the States, and I started writing for Newsday, freelancing, and I started writing articles, and I did about 30, 40 articles for them, you know, and it was great. And they were paying me $500 an article. And, you know, at one point they owed me for 9 articles, and I forgot, you know, and I didn't care about the money. I was just happy to be writing, you know, and getting published. And then I decided, you know what, I'm going to go back. I'm going to move to California from New York, and I'm going to just work on my novel. That's what I wanted to do. So I left New York, went to California in 1973. And the first thing I did when I got my phone installed was the editor of Newsday called me up, and he said, we figured out a way to get off Long Island, because all the articles that I was writing for him at that time was based on Long Island, you know, demolition derby things and the Roosevelt Raceway story, you know, going around the track with the trotters and all, did all kinds of things like that. So anyway, I said, what's your idea? And he said, we're going to interview household names. I said, okay, who do you have in mind? And they said, Mae West. And I said, Mae West. I said, well, is she still alive? And they said, well, yeah. I said, well, how do I find her? And they said, how do we know? You're the one in Hollywood. I said, okay. So I called up Paramount Pictures and got to some publicist. And I said, how do I get to Mae West? Because she had done stuff in Paramount. And they got me in touch with her publicist. She agreed to do it. And I went to see her. I wore a tie and a jacket. I took my tape recorder. I got to her place, and she wouldn't let me use a tape recorder. And I said, well, why not? And she said, well, I have let that happen before, and someone recorded my voice, and they put it made a record out of it, and I won't let that happen again. And I said, well, I'll sign something for you to say I'll never do that, because, you know, I was very nervous about, you know, not being able to record my first interview with her. But she said, no, I'm sorry. So I said, all right. So I took, luckily I had a pad with me, and luckily she spoke slowly. So, you know, I asked her a question and zoom, writing all her, whatever she said. And then, you know, as soon as I finished with her, a couple hours later, I went home and I just, as best I could, you know, transcribed my notes and turned it into as good an interview as I could, but, you know, obviously missing words here and there. So that's the first one. And they liked this interview, Newsday, and they loved the picture the photographer took. I didn't take it. And they said, use that photographer. I said, well, what about the interview? And they said, well, that's good too. I said, you mean I can interview anybody that's a household name? And they said, how about Linus Pauling? He won 2 Nobel Prizes in you know, chemistry and Peace Prize. And they said, okay. And then I said, how about Henry Moore, the artist in England? And okay, I could do him. And then as I made other suggestions, I soon found that there were very few that are household names, few scientists, few writers. Ray Bradbury I did, you know, but most of the household names were Lucille Ball and Cher and Carol Burnett and Warren Beatty. And, you know, these are the people everybody knew. So I started interviewing celebrities. And I did about 40 or 50 of them. And it was, you know, it was interesting. I'd go in. I was always a little nervous talking to these people. I talked to them usually for 2 to 3 hours. I needed to get about 3,000 words at the most. And what I started to realize about the form was I'm being allowed into these people's homes, but I'm just getting started sometimes. You know, I only prepared 30 or 40 questions because that's all I needed to, you know, I mean, to get going. So I wondered what would it be like to do an interview with somebody of this, you know, who is a well-known person, but on a very deep level, you know, for a few days, for a few weeks. And the only place I knew that could do that at the time was Playboy. Playboy did these amazing interviews, you know, and I grew up with them. So I figured out, how can I get into Playboy? They only do 12 interviews a year. They already have a handful of interviewers that they use. How does one break in as a novice, you know, to break that field? So I thought about it and I said, maybe if I interview you, Hefner, and Hefner sees what I can do, maybe I can impress him in that sense. So I suggested to do Hugh Hefner to Playboy, and they said okay. And then I spent a while trying to get the play, you know. But the fact was, Newsday, everybody in LA knew Newsday. For some reason, Newsday was a recognized newspaper based on Long Island, but you know, it had a big following. So that was good. So I went to see Hefner, and I really prepared. He thought he was going to give me an hour. I spent 2 days with him, 7 hours one day, a couple hours the next day. He took me up to his bedroom to show me his circular bed and his Monopoly set with his friends and himself as the money on the character, faces on the money. And so, but, you know, I did a lot of investigating about Playboy too, and things that would, the things that even he said he didn't know about. So when the article came out, he was really happy with it, and he felt that they had a an annual lunch in Century City at the Playboy Club or something for all the advertisers, and Hefner, and so there'd be over 1,000 people would come to this thing, and Hefner usually made an appearance and gave a speech. This year that I did the interview with him, he decided he's not going to come. He's going to give out a copy of the interview I did to everybody who comes. And that's his statement for the year, you know, who he is. So I was invited to go to that lunch. And the publicist asked me if I'd like to go. And I said, well, it'd be nice. But then he said, well, Arthur Kretschmann is going to be there. And he's the editor of Playboy. I said, bingo, I'm going, you know. So I went there with my portfolio of interviews that I had done for Newsday. And I got it, you know, they put me at a table. I'm sitting at this table. And then Arthur Kretschmer is brought to my table to meet me. And I couldn't believe it, because this is a guy you know, very hard to get to. And so I said, Mr. Kretschmer, I said, look, I did the interview, you know, with Hefner that's being passed out. I think I can do interviews for Playboy. I said, these are the people I've done, and I show them my portfolio. And he said, well, if the person in charge of the Playboy interview is this guy, Barry Goldson, he says, why don't you call him and get in touch with him in Chicago? That's all I needed, right? So I now had a name. I called up, and when I left the message, I said, Arthur Kretschmer told me to call. Now, Arthur Kretschmer was the executive editor, so it was his boss. So he called me back, and we had a conversation, and we're talking, and I tell him what I'm doing, and I said, how do I get to work for you? And he said, well, who are you trying to get to? And I named a bunch of people I was trying to reach, and one of them was Barbara Streisand.
Right.
And he said, well, we've been going after Streisand for years. We can't get to her. If you can get the Streisand, we'd be interested. So that was it. Now I had to get the Streisand. So I got in touch with our publicist. I said, look, Playboy's interested. Newsday is interested. If she talks to me, Playboy's published in like 19 countries and languages, and Newsday is syndicated to 350 newspapers. She only needs to talk one time to me, and she'll be circulated around the world. She doesn't have to talk to anybody else. So it still took another 6-8 months to get Streisand to agree to talk to me. But that's how it started, you know. And then once I did Streisand, That was a crazy interview. I mean, it took a long time, a period of 6-8 months just dealing with her once it started. And it took another almost a half a year to get to her. So we're talking about a long period of time. And I wasn't getting paid by Playboy until I finished the article. And I made the mistake of saying to Barbara, because every time I saw her, she would look at me skeptically. Mm. And then we ease into the interview, and then and at one point I said, you know, Barbara, every time I come here, it's like I have to earn your trust again and again and again. I said, either you trust me or you don't. If you trust me, let's just do this thing. If you don't, you know, okay, I'll leave. So anyway, we got into a lot of battles and fights and arguments, but we never, you know, it never stopped. Although at one point she tried to buy the interview off of me, her and John Peters. So but you know, so once that one happened, and when Playboy ended up putting her on the cover of she was the first celebrity ever to be put on the cover of Playboy. And that's what, you know, after that, very soon after I did Dolly Parton, I did Henry Winkler. And then, Playboy said, are you sitting down? You know, we have an assignment for you. I said, who? Marlon Brando. He's agreed to talk. Now that was amazing, John, because, you know, Playboy had at least a half a dozen people doing interviews for them, and all of them were senior to me. But they saw in me that I had patience, that I had perseverance, and that I wasn't going to get paid until I finished it. So they didn't cause me, you know. I guess they saw like a foolish young writer, you know, but willing to try to, you know, do anything to get the work done. So the same thing, Playboy, Brando took another year and a year and a half to get, you know, after I got the assignment and just dealing with him. But finally, he invited me to Tahiti. I went to Tahiti, spent 10 days on his island.
And this became a book, right?
It became a book, 10 days called Conversations with Brando. And the 10 days on his island is in there. And I've written a screenplay based on it, and I've come so close so often. But if anybody's out there listening, this still exists, and I don't know why. I mean, Anthony Hopkins wanted to do it. Rutger Hauer wanted to do it. They wanted to play Brando. So I had beat people. Stephen Dorff wanted to play my character, you know. And I mean, not just wanted to do it, but they read to me. They you know, pursued me. I had lunches with them. I met with Rutger Hauer in Los Angeles, and then in Poland during the Camera Image Film Festival. Mm. I mean, he said, I don't know if, you know, I'm big enough in the United States for you, but, you know, I think I could do it. I'm in. But who am I? I mean, I wasn't a producer. I just was the writer, you know, so to find somebody to say, hey, you want to do a movie with, you know, with Rutger Hauer as Brando? Nobody wanted it. But Hopkins, they, you know, they did want, but that became it's a long story. I don't know if I'll go into it now, but in the end, I fired. I got rid of Anthony Hopkins, if you can believe it. It's crazy.
My God. Let's come back to Anthony Hopkins. I'm really interested in hearing how the Marlon Brando interview went.
Yeah, well, the Brando, you know, by the way, I'm speaking about this, the Hugh Hefner and the Mae West interviews are in my new book. I did a book called Hustle, The Making of a Freelance Writer, and it just came out just today, actually, is when it's officially published on Amazon. And so what it is a series of these articles that I wrote that advanced my career in one way or another. So I included the ones like I just talked to you about, the Mae West one, because that after that I started doing other celebrity interviews. I did the Vincent Kofi one in there as well, because that was the very first one. And then the Hefner one went in, and, you know, there's a lot there. And then I put in a 12,000-word interview that's never been published with Tony Bennett to show how far I've gone. Yeah, so that this new book is kind of interesting. But anyway, back to Brando. You're asking me what it was like.
Yeah, and how long did it take to set up as well? Because if it already took,
it took a long time because he was I was dealing with his secretary. She was his assistant more than a secretary, I think. But Alice Marshak, and she wrote a book about him as well. But so Alice would tell me, you know, oh, he's doing this, he's doing that, and you know, he's got to go to deal with the Indian situation in Wyoming. He's going this. So it was always, he was always on the move, and she was always trying to land. And she was the one who said, you know, why don't I see if I can get you to go to Tahiti? That way there's nobody around. There's no telephones. You know, I said, that would be perfect. That would be great. You know, so she did her best. And one time, you know, she Brando had called me two or three times, and we talked on the phone, and he wanted to know how old I was. He wanted to know where my politics were, you know, the whole thing. You know, once he saw I was a liberal minded person, and, you know, and that I had lived in Ghana for 3 years in the Peace Corps, you know, he sort of got interested in me. So, but he kept apologizing. I'm sorry, I'm giving you the runaround, Larry, but, you know, I'm just busy here and there. And then he finally called and says, listen, you want to do this thing in Tahiti? I said, I'd love to. So then we arranged a date. It didn't work out. Another date, it didn't work out. I got married on June 1st. And on June 6th, I went to Tahiti without my wife. Just, that was my... And when I got to Tahiti, and I said, I'm glad I'm here. I said, this is my honeymoon. He says, what are you talking about? I said, I got married a few days ago. He said, why didn't you bring her? I said, well, she's Japanese. She's very pretty. And I know you have a penchant for Asian women. So I said, I didn't need the disruption.
Absolutely. I'm not risking everything on that.
Exactly. So anyway, so once I got there, I got off the plane. I was Tarita was on. It was a small plane. I flew into Papeete, and then I spent the night there. And then the next day, I go on this small plane to get to Teiteiroa. And on that plane is Tarita, who was his wife there, his Tahitian wife. She was in Mutiny on the Bounty. That's where he met her. And the child, Cheyenne, Cheyenne was about 8, I think. So anyway, very beautiful, beautiful child too. So I don't say anything to them on this plane, but we're the only 3 people on the plane. You know, I just sort of nod. I don't know what's going on here and what the protocols are, and I don't want to fuck up before I go, you know, to see him. Anyway, gets off the plane. He gives her a kiss on the cheek. He grabs the kid for a minute, and then he comes to me. And I said, "Hi, I'm Larry." He says, "I know who you are." He goes, "I have to introduce myself." Anyway, he picks up my bag, you know, that I had, and he walks me to my hut, you know, which is, you know, it's a small island, and we sit down, and he sits down with me, and we start talking, you know, in these 2 chairs looking out, and. It was, you know, we must have talked for about 45 minutes before he says, okay, I'll leave you, get settled, and I'll meet you for lunch. I said, great. So that's how it started, you know, and then as
Larry, where was his career about that? What time
he
was
had
this?
He had just made Apocalypse Now. It had not come out. I hadn't seen it.
Right.
So he had done Superman. That was the last thing I think he played Jor-El, and that one came out. And Apocalypse Now was about to come out. So that's where he was 57 years old at the time. And he was overweight, yes. He was, but he wasn't enormous, but he was big, and he did get bigger. For the first 3 days, he wouldn't let me turn. I would go to, I say, can we start taping? And he goes, no, let's just take a walk. We would walk around the island. We would go on a boat. We would go sailing, just the 2 of us. We would play chess. I'm a lousy chess player. He's a good chess player. But, you know, and he just got to hear all my stories. You know, I mean, basically, I didn't want to ask him too many things, because if I said something to him about The Godfather and did you meet was the mob involved? He'd start telling me stuff. I said, Marlon, can we hold this when we're taping? He says, I can talk, but I know that the first time is the best time. You know, the people will give you the best story then, and then they said, oh, I already talked to you about that, so they're going to be, you know, less forthcoming. So for those 3 days, I tried not to ask him too many questions, and instead told him the story of my life, and he was interested. Now, why was he interested? I found out later that Marlon was preparing to play George Lincoln Rockwell, the Nazi leader in the United States, for the show Roots. It was the last episode of Roots when Alex Haley goes to interview Rockwell. And so Marlon is observing me because I'm the Playboy interviewer coming to interview him. And he's about to play this role of Norman Lincoln Rockwell, George Lincoln Rockwell, of a character being interviewed by Playboy, because that's who Alex Haley was interviewing for Playboy. Mm. So he was prepping. You know, he was prepping with me, and I didn't know that at the time, but I realized this is who he was. So the more I talked about things, and the more I acted and, I mean, behaved, he was watching. So he was very acute in that way. You know, after the third day, I was getting a little antsy because, you know, I had my tape recorders, I had my questions, and I haven't started the interview yet. And I'm going, oh, man, this is nuts. So it was very hard to relax, even though you're on an island and it's beautiful. And, you know, the water was wonderful in the bay and everything. But nonetheless, I was there for a job. I wasn't there, you know, to get suntanned. Mm. Finally, on the fourth day, I think, I took my tape recorder with me, and I went to his bungalow, and we sat outside his bungalow, and there were these large coral rocks that were there and whatever, and we just started talking. I didn't hide it. I put the tape recorder between us, and I didn't say anything, but I turned it on, you know, so he saw that I was taping, and he didn't say no, and so he just started talking, and once that started happening, then for the rest of that day, we went into his bungalow. We taped for 5 or 6 hours. The next day, 5 or 6 hours. You know, so we taped about 15 or 20 hours of conversation that way, and you know, that's how that happened. It was a remarkable time in a way. You know, I mean, when I look back on it, I mean, I'm still talking about Brando. I'm still writing about Brando.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, he had a big effect on me, but it also had a big effect on my career, because when I got back and they published it, and by the way, Playboy said they first they weren't sure. They had an interview with John Travolta, who had just made, I guess, Saturday Night Fever or something like that. Travolta was really the big star at the time. Brando's star had faded, but he was still Brando. So I remember there was a discussion whether in the 25th anniversary of Playboy, the big magazine issue, they were deciding what should they run, John Travolta interview or the Marlon Brando interview. And I said, that's a no-brainer, man. You know, I can't even imagine that they were thinking that. But, you know, I understand, you know, popularity and all that stuff. But they went with the Brando. And once that was published, almost all the actors in Hollywood read this thing. To this day, whenever I ever talk to an actor, they've read the Brando interview, and especially Pacino. When Pacino agreed at the end of that year, this came out in 1979, I think it was 1979 in December. Al Pacino was making Cruising, and so he agreed to do a Playboy interview. It's the first interview he ever did. He never did an extensive interview before. And I got the call from Playboy, and they said, Al Pacino's, you know, agreed to do it. Can you get to New York on Thursday? This was Tuesday. And the Academy Library, where I, at that time, there was no Google, there was no, you know, internet or anything. So I had to go to the library to do my research, and they were closed on Wednesday. So I said, I can't go. I said, I'm not prepared. And they said, well, you don't understand. He said he'll only do it with the guy who did Brando. I said, oh, that's interesting. So I said, well, can you pay me more money then? And they said, okay. Then they agreed. So I got my, you know, salary increased a bit. And then I was doing Steve Martin at the time. And I had to put that aside because of this. And when I went to New York to do Pacino, we hit it off in a very unusual way. It was almost like I was meeting my older brother, and we became friendly. I would go to his apartment. He was very nervous at first about doing it. He didn't want me to put the tape recorder on, and I just said, no, I'm putting it on. I didn't want to get into another Brando situation where they tell me when I can turn the tape recorder on. So I decided from now on, I'm just wherever I am, whenever I do an interview, I turn it on. And if they don't want it on, they'll tell me, hey, turn it off. But otherwise, they'll assume I know what I'm doing.
So, right.
It happened. And that's what happened with Pacino. I ended up doing the transcript of the Pacino interview was over 2,000 pages long. And that was just, you know, that 1979 I did it.
How do you get that down into an article?
That's a whole other conversation.
Right.
That's an editing conversation. But sure. Yes, you know, I had to learn how to index because there was so much material. So I would go over everything. And, you know, if I talked about his childhood on pages 10, 15, 170, 290, and 1,000, then, you know, I would make I'd write an index, childhood, and I wrote down those pages. Same thing with any movie he made, or I talked about his mother, talked about whatever. So when I got to a comment that he makes about, let's say, when I was a kid, I did such and such and such and such, I then stopped, you know, where I was, and I went to my index. I looked up all the things he said about childhood. I took out all those pages and then started that conversation using the different pages, you know, to get into some stuff about his childhood. And then there would always be a word or something he said. It says, yeah, you know, that reminded me of when I was, doing improv. Improv. What did he do about improv? You know what I mean? And then,
right.
And then to tie it all together and make the questions work with the previous answers, so it flowed. So when you're reading the interviews I do, you read them as if they're a single seamless conversation. That's the way to read an interview. But right. In reality, you're looking at a very highly sophisticated edit of an interview. I do not edit their words. I don't change a single word they say. But they may go on. He may talk about The Godfather for four paragraphs. I may only use two sentences from each of those four paragraphs, put them together, and have a comment that is coherent and advances the story. Mm-hmm. So now that's a little controversial too with journalists. Some journalists say you can't do that. You have to, you know, you have to do verbatim. You can't do that when you have a 2,000 word.
No, absolutely not.
Transcript. You have to edit it. So, you know, that's what I was learning. I was learning on the job how to do these things. And, you know, I've been putting together my archives lately. Since I'm on the air, I can mention this, that my archive is now complete. And it's the catalog for the archive is 310 pages long, which is the longest catalog this archivist has ever put together, he said. And I have all the transcripts of all the interviews I ever did. Wow. I also have indexes for all those things. So when a researcher is looking, would ever look at this stuff, it'd be very easy for him to get to certain things they're looking for.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And I've kept a journal over since the Streisand, since 1976, I've kept a journal that is now over 10,000 single space pages long, over 5 million words. And a lot of it, most of it, is dealing with all of these people that I've dealt with,
right,
but from behind the scenes. So it's a far more detailed, intricate, revealing thing. And so I am working on it as a book. I'm trying to put, put it into my archives, the journal, I won't have a copy of it here, really. well, half of it is in my computer. The other half is typewritten. So I'm working on my next book after Hustle, after this one, of putting together this journal. And it's going to be very explosive.
That's where the bodies are buried, surely.
The bodies are buried, and I will be basically blowing up my career. But, you know, I'm at an age now where that's what's going to happen. I won't publish this for at least another year, you know, because I'm up to 1985 in working on it. It's amazing to me because I have, well, as I'm reading over the stuff that happened in seven, you know, with Henry Fonda, when Henry Fonda was, I did the last interview with him for Playboy, but when he went into the hospital, I kept going back. I was seeing him all the time, and I was writing about all this stuff and, you know, and how people came in and out and all this. So it was really kind of fascinating, you know, the behind the scenes stuff. A lot of it I forgot. Quick example. I know I'm rambling. I interviewed Miles Davis for the cable TV thing. And Miles Davis is, you know, he's an equal to Brando. He's an equal to Pavarotti. You know, I mean, there's a few people that I've done that are really iconic people. And Miles is one of them. And you know, when I went to his home, he was not there at the moment. He was somewhere in the house. And I while the crew is setting up, I walked out on his patio and I look outside and there's the ocean. It was in Malibu and I'm looking. And then I hear this voice from up above. "You're the interviewer?" I said, "Yeah, that's me." He says, "Come on up." So I go upstairs and now I'm in Miles Davis's bedroom. And we start talking for a while. Now I'm reading this in my journal. I have no memory that I was in his bedroom. I had no memory of that whole incident. I just remember sitting there with him as he was drawing and talking to him. But, you know, so it's fascinating to me that I was smart enough to, every time I finished something, I went home and wrote about it, you know, and documented.
That's so interesting because you have such a full life. It feels like, you're going to even remember some important stuff because there's just so much to remember.
It's amazing to me how much there is there that I don't remember. I mean, I just saw an incident, a personal incident where my daughter was 5 years old. We put her in this friendship day camp. One day we, you know, they're late. We did coming home and whatever. Turns out they were in a van with 8 children and the van caught fire. And the children panicked and they start crying and the car's on fire and they had to pull over and escape through the back door and the firemen came, the policemen came, you know, we find out about it all. So I'm reading about this and I called my daughter. And I said, because at 5, you should remember things like this. Yeah. I said, "Do you remember that you were in a van that caught on fire?" She said, "Don't remember it at all." So I said, "My wife, do you remember this?" She says, "I don't remember." I said, "You called it's in my journal." I said, "You called the head of the thing. You were furious. You were yelling at him. You never yell." She didn't remember either. And I didn't remember. Now, that's amazing to me, right? But if I didn't write the journal, I would never have known that it even happened.
I kind of have a similar thing when I first arrived in Italy. The first 10 years are a bit of a blur, and I don't really know why, but they sort of concertina together. Whereas I can remember things from when I was 12 years old with, you know, absolute detail. You know, it's just it's almost like your mind is elsewhere. You're concentrating on the present too much, perhaps.
Well, you know, this is the reason I tell people, you know, when I was teaching and all, I always encourage keeping a journal. I make it an assignment. You know, if you're taking a class of mine, you have to keep a journal. And at the end of the class, you have to show it to me. I will not read it, but I will skim over every single page of it. You know what I mean? I'll just look to see that you did it with the dates and everything. Because I think if you get into the habit of doing it, Truman Capote was the one who did, you know, 1982, when I was interviewed Capote from 82 to 84, he asked me, "Do I keep a journal?" And I said, "Yeah, I do." And he says, "It's very important, you know." And he told me that so many of the pieces he wrote in Music for the Chameleons, his book of essays, the piece about Marilyn Monroe, the piece about getting stoned with his maid and going to different people's homes and dancing with the maid, and all these articles that he wrote, he said they all come straight out of his journal, you know. I mean, and I understand that. When Henry Fonda died, I wrote a piece about him in my journal. And then the LA Times editor called me up and said, can you write something for us for the op-ed page? I said, okay, great. When do you need it? He says, in 2 hours. I said, no, I can't do that. I can't write that fast. And he says, well listen, if we can't have it for tomorrow's paper, then it's old news already. We have to. So I said, well, I wrote something in my journal. He says, read it to me. So I just pulled up my journal. It was just, I just finished writing it. And I read him what I wrote in the journal. He says, that's fine. That's perfect. Send, fax it to me at the time. So I faxed that to him. And the next day, there it is in the LA Times op-ed page, right? Full page, all about me and Henry Fonda. So you get to see how important a journal can be, you know, and you never know what's going to happen with it.
Absolutely. And it's such a chastening story, that as well, of the editor saying Henry Fonda dying will be old news the day after.
Yeah, the day after. Exactly. Oh. Exactly. That's the truth, though.
Yeah. Back to Pacino, because Pacino, again, you know, you wrote the book about Brando and the experience of staying on the island. By the way, side note, I reckon Tom Hardy would make a great Brando.
I love Tom Hardy.
Yeah, I just think physically he has that same prowess, you know.
Well, Tom Hardy's best movie, I think, is Bronson.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, brilliant.
I mean,
movie.
That blew my mind. When I saw Bronson, I said, whoa, who is this guy? You know, I don't buy DVDs very often. I bought that one. I wanted to own Bronson. And I just thought it was a terrific movie. And I like everything he does. You know, I mean, he's sometimes a little subtle. Sometimes he's not, you know, but he's a good actor. And you're right. I appreciate that thought, because the people I thought would make good Brandos is James Spader and Woody Harrelson. And Woody Harrelson, I never would have thought of, but Jeff Bridges, who I know and I email with, I wanted him to play Brando. And Jeff said to me, I couldn't do Brando. I never could. He says, but he read the script. And he said, and then he called me up and he says, I know who should do this. I know it's perfect. Woody should do it. He's got the nose. He's got the attitude. Yeah. And I said, wow, you're right. But I can't get to Woody Harrelson. He's very hard to get to. And then, and James Spader, I interviewed him for Playboy. But I can't get to him so easily either. So those are the two that I thought. And I will agree with you about Hardy. And I'm going to make a note of it right now.
Yeah. So if you in 2 years' time, we see the 10 Days on an Island with Brando, the movie starring Tom Hardy, I've got points.
You got it. That's a great suggestion. I love him.
Well, so again, Pacino. So with Pacino, you end up, you start with this interview, and it's really interesting that William Friedkin, who passed away recently, he sort of has a run-in with Pacino, or there's an experience with Pacino, and you meet Pacino directly after that. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that moment?
That's an okay. So this is when I first got to know Al, and he was making Cruising. And I went to New York, and you know, there was it was a very controversial movie before it even came out, because everybody knew it was about the gay world and the S&M world in New York. And so Al was nervous about how it's going to be treated, and so there were protests. In his, I would be in his, trailer. That would be parked, and we'd be sitting there, and you'd hear the whistles. And he says, "Listen to them; those are all the gay people. They're whistling. They got whistles. They sound like crickets." He said, but it was not an anti-gay movie. But and Al certainly wasn't trying to, playing something like that. But he was concerned, and so he came out after the movie was finished and being edited. I was back in New York, LA, and he was in New York. And so he came out and he told me, "Listen, I'm coming out to see if I can see some of the outtakes and how it's being edited. And why don't we meet for lunch? I'm going to see Billy Friedkin around 9, 10 in the morning." So we went, there was this place on Sunset, the Imperial Gardens. It was a Chinese place. I think it was Chinese, maybe it was Japanese. But anyway, so I said, okay, I'll meet you there at noon or 1 o'clock. Mm. So I get there at around the time we planned, about, let's say, one. And he sits, it was raining, which is rare in LA already, and he's out, he's standing in front of the place because it was closed, and I didn't know it was closed on that day. It's probably a Monday or something. And he looked very forlorn, and I said, hey, you know, what's going on? And he goes, you can't believe this. He says, I went to the studio, to Tadayo Studios, to see it, and he wouldn't let me see it. I said, what do you mean he wouldn't let you see it? He said, I go in. He says to me, what are you doing here? And Al said, well, you know, I'm in LA. I just thought I'd take a look, see what, you know, see if I can give you any suggestions or whatever. He says, no, you can't see it. I don't want you to see it. And he just would not let him see it. And Al just walked away, you know, and he turned around and he can't. And I said, well, how long have you been waiting here? He says, about 40 minutes. So I felt so bad. So then we tried to go to another restaurant, and that was closed. And then we went to another restaurant, and that was closed. So we finally got to this one restaurant that finally was open. We got a place that, you know, we talked. Anyway, he ends up going to see Friedkin a few days later to talk about it. And Friedkin was also, he was just not nice to him about it, you know. Mm. And Al knew that there must be a problem with the movie. And in a way, there was, because the movie, if you read the book, Cruising, every other chapter is about the cop and the killer, the cop and the killer. So the movie should have been equal. And the killer at the time was Richard Cox, who became a friend of Al's and a friend of mine after I got to know him. And Richard Cox thought he was going to, you know, co-star in this movie. And it was a big break for him. You know, it was a major movie for him. But the way Friedkin edited it, you hardly saw Cox. It was all about Pacino, you know, and his character. And so it was unbalanced. It was especially right from the way the book was written. Anyway, so Al was pretty upset about Friedkin. Now, a couple of years go by, maybe three, four, whatever, and I'm doing these interviews for Playboy Cable TV, and we're going to interview Billy Friedkin. So, you know, we set up, we're on camera, and I asked him, I said, what happened with you and Al Pacino during the making of Cruising? He says, nothing happened. I said, well, you know, but he came in to see you, and you were to see the editing, and you wouldn't let him in. That's not true. That never happened. And he's lying to me, right? And I'm on camera with him. But how much could, you know, how far do you go in a TV you know, I don't want him to walk out on me, right? And I don't want to say you're a liar. I did this, but I did say something like, well, I was with Al that afternoon, you know, and I saw him, and he said that never happened. He completely denied it. Anyway, I told Al this when I, you know, after the interview, I said, I just talked to Friedkin. He says, nah, fuck, you know, anyway. So then a couple of years go by again, and Al's on an airplane going either to or from New York to LA, and he gets into the first class, and then there's Billy Friedkin is on the plane with him. So Friedkin goes over to him and he puts out his hand to shake his hand, says, hey Al, how are you? Al said to me, I looked at his hand, I couldn't shake it.
Oh my god,
he never forgave him for that, you know. Now that we're talking ill of the dead, and so that's not always a good thing. Friedkin made some very good films, but he was a volatile man, multi-married, and this is the Al Pacino story about Billy Friedkin.
it's the same with I was mentioning Michael Parkinson earlier, and you know, Billy Friedkin. Now there was it was interesting that there were all these you know, quite rightly, pians of praise for him. On my Facebook, in a sort of journalist group, this guy wrote a very long post about how Friedkin was the rudest person he's ever interviewed. And I think, you know, there's a time for everything, and maybe not the time's not now, but it is also, you know, you do also have to, yeah, let's not speak bad of the dead, but also let's not be too...
No, you got to be honest about things. Yeah. I mean, you know, to me, the hardest interview, the one that was the rudest to me was Robert Mitchum.
Right. That sounds like a nightmare. I mean, it was
horrible. And ironically, I mean, do you want me to talk about that? That's a
sure. Sure. I mean, I love Mitchum as an actor. I love Baby, I Don't Care, the Lee Server biography of him. Right. But please tell us about this encounter, because right. I think,
well, before I do, I just a quick aside with the Pacino book I sure. did. The Pacino in Conversation, that's available in Italy, and it's that actually, of all the books I've done, it was the first book I ever did where it earned back its advance before it was even published, because
wow, for pre-orders,
something like 12 or 14 publishers, foreign publishers published the book, including in China. It was translated into Chinese, so that was quite something. And Al wrote the foreword to that, which was very surprising because he never writes it.
But then are you still close to Pacino?
I'm not as close to him as I was. He was my best friend for 35 years, so I was very close to him. And he asked me to be in his movie, the Salome movie, Wild Salome. And so I said, "Why do you want me in your movie?" I said, "It's about, you know, Herod, King Herod, and John the Baptist. What are you talking about?" He said, "Well, I want you to be like the biographer. You come in and ask me questions while I'm talking to people. Just interrupt me," he says. I thought that was strange, but I said, okay, I did. So I'm in the movie and I'm throughout the movie, I'm in the movie without talking. I'm just walking with them all the time, and this, walking wherever we went. And so I said to him, I'll do it. It was a year long project or more. And I said, but why don't I actually write a book about it? You know, I'll keep a thing. And he said, okay, that's a good idea. So I wrote a book about being in the movie. And it's called I Want You in My Movie, My Acting Debut and Other Misadventures Filming Al Pacino's Wild Salome. So when I had a publisher that wanted to do it, and I told Al, I said, "Al, I found a publisher. This is great." And he says, "No, the movie's not ready. It's not ready." I said, "Well, it's not going to, the book wouldn't come out until the movie comes out." I said, that's, but the point is publishers need a year to get it ready and all that stuff. Anyway, he got upset and he said, "No." And I said, "I'll give you the manuscript to read. Don't worry about it. It's positive. It's all about, your genius, so to speak, Anyway, he got very pissed off about it, and I canceled the contract. And that pissed me off because I felt he was impinging upon my artistic freedom. And that it didn't make sense to me for him to do that, especially since we were as close as we were. It was like, as I say, I was closer to him than I was to my own sister. And so so I got annoyed with him about this. And in the end, I published the book by myself. So I self-published it, so nobody's ever seen it really on Amazon, but it exists, and it's quite an incisive book, I think, and it really does show you the way his mind works and everything else. He was mad at me about it, but we have since been emailing and texting, although he doesn't like the email. So that's that little piece of thing. And I also wrote a novel called Begin Again Finnegan. And it's sort of based on my relationship and what happened with him. It's fictionalized, but,
How Joycean is it? Because with that title.
Very Joycean. Begin Again Finnegan is basically about Finnegan's Wake. I mean, about Joyce.
I just finished Finnegan's Wake after 10 years.
Did you really?
Yeah. I'm beginning again because
that's great. Well, listen, I've done it too. I mean, I've listened to Joyce reading sections of it on the Cadman radio record. I've tried reading this thing a number of times. I will not dare say I've read the whole thing in because it's impossible in a way, but yeah. I have read, Joyce has always been my favorite writer. And so in this book, in this novel, I have the character, the actor, and the journalist. Now there's a death that occurs, but while that's scandal is happening back home, the actor says, "Why don't we just go and make this film about the James Joyce's exile?" So that's what they do. And there's an entire chapter about the making of this film, and it's all about Joyce and Finnegan. And the whole thing about Begin Again Finnegan is when the actor gets really angry at the journalist. And he tells him, he says, you're going to have to begin again. You're going to have to begin again, Finnegan, and he's really angry. So anyway, but that's I like that novel. I wrote a screenplay based on it, never showed it to anybody, but it exists.
Wow.
Anyway, yeah, you might be interested in checking that out. I think you can get that in Italy.
Certainly.
It's a paper. As a matter of fact, just as a quick aside, That book is on sale. I don't put these books on sale, but every once in a while, Amazon chooses one of my books. I have 32 books, and they lower the price to some ridiculous price. So they've lowered the price of that paperback to $4.95 or $4.50. That's the same price as the Kindle. So you can actually get that paperback. It's normally $16. But
brilliant. I'll look out for that.
I don't even know why they did that, but that's the book they chose to lower. So I thought, well, that maybe that'll sell. Anyway, back to Mitchum.
Yeah, let's do Mitchum. yeah, it's a bit of a dark story, but not necessarily a surprising one given his reputation for being ornery. Is that the American word?
He was ornery. Yes. Yeah. Well, I went to see him. He was making that championship season in 1985, and Playboy had wanted to interview Mitchum for 15 years or something. You know, they never could get him. For some reason, the publicist calls me up and says, "You want to meet Mitchum?" I said, "Yeah, I want to interview him." He said, "Well, why don't we start in the beginning and, you know, I'll introduce you. I'll get you." Okay. So I go to the movie set. He's making this movie. And then during the break for lunch, I go to it wasn't a trailer. It was an office, I guess, on the Zoetrope lot. Mm. And so I go in there and he orders he gets a sandwich, he has a drink, doesn't offer me even water, nothing. I'm just sitting there, right? So that's already kind of nasty, but okay. Mm. And we start talking and I see that he doesn't really want to talk much. So I start dropping names. I was on Brando's Island, I've done Al Pacino, I did George C. Scott, you know, and then and he couldn't care less, right? So I'm saying to him, listen, maybe you don't really want to do this interview, do you? And he goes, not really. I said, why don't we do this? I said, why don't we just tape an hour? You know, it doesn't have to be now. You're obviously working, but I can come back. We'll do an hour. If you don't like my questions, if you don't like me after the hour, I will give you the tape. I'll walk out and nobody will ever see it.
No foul, no harm.
Yeah. So I said, I mean, I never did that before. I never offered anybody something like that before. But, you know, I was confident that I could at least ask some good questions and see, you know, maybe see what he's like. I had no other choice because he wasn't moving along any other way. And then he looks at me and he says, well, that's just it. He says, it's the first questions. It's the first hour. And I looked at it. I said, well, Mr. Mitchum, I just here doing my job. You know, this is what I do. Mm. And he says, that's what Eichmann said. I said, excuse me? Yeah, that's what Adolf Eichmann said. Just doing your job. And I said, are you comparing doing a Playboy interview with what Adolf Eichmann did to the Jews? And he said, same thing, same thing. And And I just stood up and I said, you know, Mr. Mitchum, your publicist has my number. It was nice to meet you. And if you want to talk, just let me know. And I walked out, you know, I just said, you know, this guy's nuts. And he had said some anti-Semitic things in Esquire before this too. Mm. So I'd known that he was anti-Semitic. But then some time goes by and let me see where it is. Okay. So then I start writing the Houstons and John gives me a letter, John Houston telling everybody that I'm interested in talking to, that they should talk to me and tell the truth. So I sent this letter out to everybody, including Mitchum. So I get a call from Mitchum. I had had an accident. I fell off a ladder. I broke my arm. My one eye was out of my head for a while. My nose was broken. And the 2 days after I get back from the hospital, the phone rings. Bob, this is Bob Mitchum. I said, oh, and he doesn't remember me from previously. Yeah. This is now 2 or 3 years later. So I said, oh, hello, Mr. Mitchum. You're responding to my letter. He says, that's why I'm calling. I said, great. I said, I'll be able to see you. He says, you can come tomorrow. I said, well, I just came out of the hospital. I said, I have a broken arm. And he says, that's okay. You can come tomorrow. And he's up in Santa Barbara. I'm in LA. So I said, okay, so what choice did I have, right? So now I look back on it now and I think, God, I should have hired a driver to take me there. But I did. I drove there with my left hand, my right hand's in a sling. I can't see out of one eye. I drive up to Mitchum's place. And I go to his house. I look like Quasimodo. You know what I mean? I'm really like messed up. And he opens the door. It doesn't say a word. Not like, Jesus, what happened to you? No, he sits down and we start talking. Well, he's a good storyteller when it came to talking about John Huston and working on Heaven Knows Mr. Allison and one other film he did with him. Was it The List of Adrian Messenger? Maybe, I don't know, something like that. So I left. I never brought up the Playboy interview with him or anything like that. But then when there was a documentary being made about Huston, and they brought the African Queen, the boat from wherever it was in Florida, I think, to Hollywood, and they put it in a warehouse. And they asked me, they told me Mitchum was going to narrate 18 different sections of this documentary. And he's on the boat. They're going to start it on the boat, I think. So he's at the front of the boat and he starts talking and he does the first narration. And when he finishes, you know, they're filming it, he looks at the director and he goes, "Too Jewish?" And everybody laughed, right? They thought, oh, you know, very funny. Okay. So he says, okay, I'll do it again. Every single take, first take of each 18 parts, he said the same thing. Too Jewish? And it was so uncomfortable because the director was Jewish. A lot of the staff was Jewish.
What does that even mean, too Jewish? Like, I mean, what?
That's a good, you know.
Does it have any sort of...
Too much inflection, too much this, too much that. I can't even explain what he actually means, except that it was not a nice thing to say after a while because it made everybody so uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I witnessed it. You know, I was there.
Yeah, yeah.
It was quite something. So that was Mitchum. So I never did it for Playboy. I did do it for the Huston book though.
Yeah, and I mean, you've had some. I mean, talking of you know, anti-Semitic, you've interviewed Mel Gibson. I mean, one of the and you know that interview, the way you've described it in your book was, he shows his true colors straight away as well.
Yeah, yeah.
In terms of his misogyny more than his anti-Semitism in that case, but I haven't ever interviewed him, but I did see him at a press. I was attended a couple of press conferences and asked him a couple of questions during them. And Hacksaw Ridge, I think, was the last one. And he scrawled and did caricatures with a magic marker on the desk of the news conference place. And it was just like one of those weirdest things. It looked like someone having an episode, you know?
Well, Mel's a strange guy, but then you got to go back to his father and see what kind of guy his father was, you know.
Right, yeah. His father actually wrote a book called Is the Pope Catholic?
Yeah, right, right. He was challenging even the Pope. Yeah. Well, you know, I'll tell you something though, but Mel and I got along very well. You know what I mean? As a matter of fact, I even invited him once. I told him that I play poker with Pacino, Harry Dean Stanton, George Hamilton, Elliot Gould. You know, we played cards regularly every 2 weeks or every week almost. And sometimes it was at my house, sometimes it was somewhere else. At Al's, Al would rent the Beverly.
Was this poker for money or?
Yeah. We played poker. So, and I never, yeah, I mean, these guys have a lot of money and I don't, you know, I learned to play poker. So anyway, so one time, we were going to play at George Hamilton. He was going to host it. And Hamilton had an Indian cook that was going to make food. And then we were going to smoke cigars and have good wine. It was going to be, he made it a very interesting evening. So there was room at the table, I think. I think we had six or so. So Mel had said to me, "Oh, if you ever play cards, I'd love to join you." I said, "Okay." So I called Gibson. I said, "Hey, you want to do? We're going to be playing at Hamilton's house. Al will be there." He said, "Y'all would love to do it. I'll come. What time?" You know, so I tell him, I give him the address, I give him the time, and then Al calls me up later and says, "So who's coming to the game?" I said, "Well, you know, it's the regulars, everybody." I said, "But Mel Gibson's going to come." Why Mel? I said, well, he wanted to come. He's a big fan of yours. And then what? He says, Larry, you don't understand. He says, I don't want to have to be on when I go play poker. He says, it's just something I feel, want to feel comfortable with. You know, Mel, I don't know him. So it's like I'm thinking, you know, it's like one big star and another, because Mel at that time was Braveheart and all that stuff. So he was pretty big, you know. And so now what am I going to do? I've already invited him, right? I was asking me, please, you know. So I call Mel and I said to him, I just want to let you know, I said that, you know, it turned out that we have eight players. So you would be the ninth, but that's okay. I said, you know, because we can fit you in and then, you know, we'll take turns sitting out, blah, blah, blah. So he said, you know, I'll come another time. And he says, okay, you know, you have enough. I said, you sure?
Oh. He said, yeah. I got only say you sure once. Don't really insist.
I'm sure once. So now if Mel Gibson ever hears this story, he will know what happened.
No, he's not going to listen. I don't think he listens to writers on film. Al does. Al does. So that'll be good.
Yeah, there you go. Al, why are you talking about me? Oh, God.
I mean, one of the darker interviews that you have in that book was actually surprisingly with Anthony Hopkins, and not because he sort of, you know, does anything that we would conventionally think, but just because his philosophy feels so pessimistic and nihilistic.
Yeah, that's Hopkins. I mean, he goes, you know, actors are nothing. Actors are nothing. He goes, you know, Shakespeare, what, who is Shakespeare? You should burn it. You should burn down the Stratford on Avon, burn it to the ground. You don't have to do it. You know, I mean, he's just like, he's cynical about things. And he's a cynical guy, you know, and he's just, you know, and yet he's a great actor, you know, I mean, you know, and he talked about his process where, you know, he would make us to learn his lines. He would draw a circle and then he would do a pie chart and he would, you know, do like 20, he did, I think he did a pie chart of five times and he would do five circles, five pies, slices in each one. And each time he did his lines and memorized it, he would, you know, shade it in that thing. Mm-hmm. And when he shaded it all five circles, that, you know, he had practiced 25 times his lines. And he felt that's how he learned his lines. Wow. Interesting. It's always interesting to hear how people's process. You know, Joyce Carol Oates once showed me, I was at her home in Princeton, and she was working on a book. I said, boy, you know, you just knock out a book and one after the other. How do you keep all these characters in mind? And she goes, she shows me that she wrote a backstory for every character of every novel she's done. She showed me like 180 or 200 pages that she writes before she starts writing the novel. So she knows where these characters come from. It has nothing to do with the novel in a sense, but it has to do with how she sees them. I thought that was like incredibly deep.
Yeah, I loved her book, Blonde. I loved, I think I loved it more than the film, but...
Oh, it's much better than the film. The film had flaws.
I think the book is more obviously a work of art and less. I mean, it's like James Ellroy, who you also interview. You know, he's so obviously in his own fantasy land that it really doesn't matter. It really doesn't. You don't really have to worry about, oh, this is offensive to the real people, because it's, well, you know, this isn't the real people. Right. Yeah. Listen, Larry, we could have hours and hours of talk. So I hope you'll come back and talk to me again at some point. But there is one final question that I have to ask you, which is, could you recommend a film book for our listeners?
Well, you know, I will just mention two of my books, the one Conversation with Brando and the other is The Houstons, that are, you know, part of this what is it, AFI, or the Hollywood Reporter is doing the 25 best books of the thing. And there are certain people like Rod Lurie and all who are writing saying, I just voted for your book for the best book, you know, all that stuff. So I'm very proud of those books. Mm. But if I was going to just recommend certain books that I did write the 25 I did. But I would say that, you know, there are a couple of novels that I would recommend. One is Bud Schulberg's What Makes Sammy Run.
Yes.
The other is Nathaniel West's Day of the Locust. I think those are two very good. And the third might be Get Shorty, Elmore Leonard's Get Shorty. Those are three good books to read about the Hollywood situation, people. I thought Lillian Hellman's Picture about the making of the Red Badge of Courage and all about John Huston was a very well done book. And a matter of fact, it was Truman Capote was inspired to do his book, The Muses Are Hurt, after as a nonfiction kind of novel, based on what he read with Hellman's Picture.
Oh,
and then William Goldman's Adventure in the Screen Trade. Klaus Kinski's Uncut, Clint Kinski Uncut, his autobiography is a very good autobiography. It's written in the first person. In the present tense. So he starts it out where he's a kid. I'm in the thing, I'm with my father, and he goes in and he tries to steal some groceries, and he wants me to steal some apples or something under my shirt, and the grocer comes out and I'm running, and it was Pacino who was reading that book and says, you got to read this book. He says, if I ever write a book, I'd like to write it like this. He says, it's really, you feel like you're in it right throughout. So those are just some books, that I would recommend people might want to take a look at.
I've never heard of that Kinski one. That sounds fascinating. I have to see if I can dig it out somewhere.
Called Kinski Uncut.
Brilliant. Yeah. Brilliant. Well, again, thanks so much, Larry, for talking to me. And I'd love to have you on when you have your next book out, and we can talk about that.
That's great. And if anybody ever gets any of my books, I will be happy to keep coming back.
Brilliant.
Somebody out there, it's hard to, it's very hard to find readers, because I don't advertise. And I've been self-publishing books. My first dozen books or so were published by major publishers, the Houstons and the Brando and the Michener book and the Capote book and stuff like that. But then I just started wanting to write my own books, the novels I've written and the short stories and the memoirs and stuff like that. And so I've just been working on, putting out my own books. Amazon made me a very nice offer to do everything, and it's not costing me anything to do it. But I don't get any publicity, and I don't get any royalties. So it's like you're putting out books and you're just hoping that somehow, somewhere in the world, people are getting books. The one on Ava Gardner, by the way, is the one that seems to be the biggest book in Europe.
All right.
Always seeing somebody buying an Ava Gardner book. They like that book.
Excellent. Well, I hope. Well, Ava Gardner. Sorry, what was it called? Conversations.
Called Conversations with Ava Gardner.
Excellent. Yeah. So I'm sure we've got some Ava Gardner fans out there who
there's
were,
a lot of them out there. It's amazing to. All right. Well, listen, it was lovely talking to you, and we'll talk again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Larry. Take care.
Okay. Bye now.
Bye bye. So that was me and Lawrence Grobel talking about our experiences interviewing people. That was me interviewing the interviewer, and I hope I did a good enough job for you. It is almost impossible to do a bad interview with this man because he is so clever, so interesting, so insightful, so funny and entertaining. I would just love to sit back and spend a whole evening with him, picking his brains and listening to his war stories, of which there are many. It's amazing. I loved it. Loved that experience. I hope you did too. And I can't wait to have him back on the show so that we can talk about some of the things that we never had a chance to talk about. Thanks so much to Elliot Atkins for the music, and thanks to you, listener. I hope to hear. I hope you come back. Okay, take care.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.